College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Negandhi.
Hey, and welcome back to the College Football Podcast. It's been a while, and a lot of things have changed. And I'm glad that at least we could still talk about college football as we get ready for the NFL draft in a matter of a couple weeks. And we want to make sure everybody that's listening that you're safe and healthy and you're following the guidelines of staying indoors, because we've got to flatten this curve in the spring and the early parts of the summer if we want to have football in the fall. That is the one thing that stands out to me. Let's flatten the curve now, a little bit of the sacrifice, and then we could reap the benefits of talking about college football and following the sport that we all love. On the podcast today is the great Todd McShay, who's been with ESPN for over a decade, breaking things down with the NFL draft. And he also is on the road during the college football season, sidelines with the Levy Greasy broadcast booth and Molly McGrath, where those guys are at fantastic games and having so much fun. McShay still finds time to carve out his mock drafts and give us some time about his thoughts about that draft that starts in a couple weeks. And he joins us here in the College Football Podcast. And then later on, we talk a little bit about his relationship with Mel Kiper. And the one thing that stood out when Frank Caliendo impersonated Kiper next to McShay. Enjoy. All right, we're less than 2 weeks away from the NFL draft in the new normal. And it's great to have Todd McShay join us here, part of ESPN's coverage as well as ABC's coverage, and we'll see how this plays out as we try to do this the virtual way. Todd, first off, we do appreciate you joining us here on the podcast. What's it been like for you when it comes to gathering information compared to previous years as you kind of find your way through the pandemic?
Yeah, it's been interesting. It really has. It's been so different than any other year, obviously. You know, everyone's understanding of what's going on, and every GM I've talked to in the last 2 weeks, you know, they're trying to figure out what they're going to do. Their IT people are working around the clock. They're worried about draft weekend and like making trades and how they're going to go through every little detail, to the point where, you know, they've got people in their houses setting stuff up, but they don't want people in their houses.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for the same reasons, and they're talking, all the GMs are talking to each other via text saying, you know what, if we get down to the clock and we're about to make a trade or want to do something, let's make sure that we can text each other just in case, you know, my Wi-Fi goes out or my kids come running in the room. It's just, it's really, really strange and different. And it's been interesting just talking to everyone and how everyone's kind of dealing with the same stuff.
Todd, how are they conducting the interview process? Like, especially when you want to meet a quarterback, you need to understand things, and you have these, you know, I just think of Tua Tagovailoa off the top of my head. And of course, with the tape sent to the 32 teams of his own workout, and you don't get the chance to have your doctors look at him, and you don't get the chance to see his personality in a room. How are GMs and executives and coaches handling that situation with each individual prospect where they have extended questions outside of the tape?
Yeah. So every year, typically, you get 30 players that you get to bring into your facility. You can't work them out when you bring them to your place. You can only spend the day with them. You can, you know, put them on the board. You can watch tape with them, do all those sorts of things. You can't do anything physically. This year, they can't do any of that. So they are missing out on having that time with individuals, but they're still, you know, they're like everyone else. They're on Zoom and Skype and FaceTime and just trying to spend as much time as they can with these players. And medically, they're still sending out doctors. I mean, you know, people will tell you whatever they want to tell you, but I can tell you, talking to general managers, they're sending out doctors specifically to the players that they really think that they have a chance of drafting. And that's kind of how they're handling it.
Do you anticipate, let's just say night number one,
we have seen stuff in the past where there's a surprise or a shocker or something's released, and I imagine social media will be running rampant. Do you anticipate something like that happening and the percentages being higher considering everybody's virtual this time around?
Huh. That's a good question. I mean, if I knew, then it wouldn't be, right? But it really is a good question because I think you have to understand, teams have been sending scouts out for 15 months, basically, evaluating all of these players, you know? So they have so much information. So I don't think it's going to be a big difference, but I do think in this last month or so that there's less information coming in. And I think that's what teams are most worried about, these two things. One, are we missing out on something information-wise? And two, what happens when I'm on the clock draft weekend? That's mm-hmm. Bandwidth, IT, those are the words I hear constantly talking to these guys because they're so worried about it. But they're also – it's interesting to talk to them because the – GMs that I've talked to are like, all right, now how do I get an edge? How do I use this to my advantage? Right.
Yep.
So that's been kind of the interesting part to hear when you're talking to these guys. Like they're so, you know, they understand what's going on. They have wives and kids like all of us, and the day to day is shocking, but at the end of the day, they're still trying to get an edge. They're still trying to find the best players, and they're still trying to figure out how they can do something better than, you know, the other 31 GMs in the league to try to see if they can maybe get that like tiny little bit of an edge.
You also look at, you know, you want to hit on the first round, the second round, the third round, but I also think about the back end when you're filling your roster up, right? And this is a different world when it comes to right after the draft. You see a bunch of moves and transactions because, you know, these guys are undrafted free agents that are sitting around. It feels like it's going to be more chaos after the draft as well. Do you anticipate that when guys are trying to fill the back end of their roster with guys, hey, can we get a special teams player? This guy made it out of the seventh round. Let's go get him right now. What do you anticipate on that back end?
Well, so what – the few guys that I've talked to about like what their exact situations are, that one of them rented out a whole hotel. Mm-hmm. And so, but they can only bring 9 people in, right? You got to keep it under 10. So they've got 9 people in, but then they're trying to set up their whole draft board and then be able to talk to all their scouts and go back and forth. And they're, one GM that I talked to was saying it's frustrating because I pause and then there's like that 1.5 second delay that we have on TV.
Yes.
And I was like, yeah, that's called a delay, bud. But he's like, I don't know if they're listening to me or what's going on. I was like, yeah, it's just it's a delay. But so they're going back and forth, going through all that kind of different stuff. But what I've learned from talking to them is that their scouts are, I mean, they're lining it up just like they always do. But each individual scout is going to be hustling at the end of the draft and right when the draft ends to be able to call or to text a player and try to put a deal in place for $5,000, $7,000, whatever it is, to try to get those players in. But it'll be a little bit of chaos, but it won't be that much different from year to year in terms of how it's handled that way.
All right, let's move on to the players because I've been chomping at the bit. When you look at this draft, it's obviously highlighted by the quarterbacks like every single draft with the Burrow and the intrigue at Tua Tagovailoa and which team is going to make a move or does Miami just sit there at 5? What's the latest you're hearing right now about Tagovailoa, Herbert, as well as Jordan Love?
Miami loves Joe Burrow, and they would love to go up and get him. They're trying everything they can possibly try to figure out a way to do it, but I don't think Cincinnati's going to allow them to get Joe. I think Joe's just going to be the first overall pick, and I think Cincy's going to take him. Then Miami's got a decision to make. You know, do they Do they use some of those picks that they have? They've got, what is it? They've got 5 in the first 2 rounds, 6 in the top 70 overall. Are they going to try to package a couple of those picks and move up to, let's say, Detroit at number 3 and make a move with them in order to make sure that they go get Tua Tagovailoa? Now, I keep hearing about Justin Herbert and Miami, and I don't know if that's – I know they love Joe Burrow. I think they like Tua a lot. But I've heard some whispers, but not from anyone within the Miami organization about Justin Herbert. But I've heard some of those rumors. And then I think Jordan Love's a better player. And I think he's going to be a better player if developed properly. So that's the interesting part. You got the Chargers sitting right behind them and, you know, all the movement that we've seen with the quarterbacks, but I don't think we'll see more than 3 in the top 10 go, and Jordan Love may be the 4th, and I'll mail a check. But.
Well, let's make sure everybody understands the backstory to that is you and I, as well as Mel, were on the set SportsCenter during the week of the combine. Yep. And you guys were going back and forth about Jordan Love and Justin Herbert. I want to tell the audience that's listening, this is real. Like this, there's no like, hey, I'm going to take a stance, you take a stance, and we'll just talk it out and debate. No, none of that. You guys are passionate about what you believe in and the research that you guys do. And you are all about Jordan Love being the 3rd quarterback taken in this draft, or should be.
And Mel bugged me, by the way.
Yes, he did.
So we were going to have a $5,000 bet.
Yep.
To go to the V Foundation. Obviously, like, couldn't be a better, a better situation. Everyone's going to win. But we were supposed to have a $5,000 bet on our final mock draft. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting on that set that day, and I said something about Jordan Love, and I was like, listen, he's a better quarterback. I like him more than Justin Herbert. And he's like, all right, so let's make the bet right now. And then you made that it was finalized right there.
Well, listen, there was blood and water. I had to jump in and just say, listen, let's finalize this right now. We can't leave this hang. So my job was to make sure that we saw a handshake and that you guys were committed to what you guys were saying on both sides for the audience. So I thought
you nailed it that day.
Well, I thought you guys were really good with that because honestly, you guys still believe it now. Teams may defer and teams may say we think differently, but there's one conversation that we had earlier this week on SportsCenter where Mel brought up the Raiders at 12, and you like that concept, and you could see that concept that if we do not have 4 quarterbacks go in the top 10, you could see somewhere where the Raiders sitting at 12 find a way to make a move or find a way to make the pick there with potentially Jordan Love.
Yeah, I could see it. I really could. We both know Gruden and he's always looking for the next quarterback and looking to see someone different. Now, he loves veterans though. He loves guys that have some experience and know the game. So that'll be the interesting part. But I could see it. I could definitely see it. And there are guys in the league that I talk to that really like Herbert more than Jordan Love. And there are some guys in the league that think that Jordan Love is going to be so much better than Herbert. And it's interesting to just like hear the differences when you talk to one guy versus the next guy. Right. But yeah, Gruden, you never know. And he loves quarterbacks. It's like a quantity thing. He wants all of them. Quarterbacks.
Yeah, look at the tape in Tampa, and also look where he found his comfort zone. He found his comfort zone with veterans like Rich Gannon, and he's aware of Brad Johnson. He brought in a bunch of guys, and then he was super hard on Chris Sims, who was a young quarterback. Like you mentioned, he loves veterans. So you see where he brings in Marcus Mariota there, And potentially if you have a Jordan Love, sit and watch and wait, and you have the veteran you could lean on. And of course, let's not forget about the scenario with Carr, but he falls in and out of love with his quarterbacks every single week on every single pass.
Yeah,
and
that's how he's been. QB ADD.
Yes, he does. That's a great way to describe it. If Tua Tagovailoa didn't get hurt in November, would he be the number one pick in your mind?
I think he would be. It's interesting because you go back and you have to study it. And in the last 10 years, there have been seven quarterbacks who have been first round draft picks, who have been injured in college, and all seven of them have been injured in the NFL. And they've got to be available, right? I mean, that's the most important thing. So even though the hip injury was the final piece of the puzzle, if you will, medically, but he's been injured almost every single year of his career. And while, like, you get to know him and he's the best dude, like, everyone loves him. Everyone loves playing with him and playing for him. He's so talented that it doesn't take a super scout to figure that out. But the medical part is the difference. And even, if it wasn't for the hip, I think it would be a toss up and I think it would be a bigger debate. But I do think that that's kind of the tiebreaker. But if you were just telling me guaranteed 10 years, crystal ball, that they're both going to be healthy, I would take Tua over Joe Burrow, but it would be so close. And I'm shocked even thinking that, going back to like last summer studying the tape between the two, because it wasn't even a debate. Joe Burrow was like a fourth or fifth round pick, and then all of a sudden he just exploded.
How does a kid explode? Like, I mean, we saw that with Kyler Murray as well, right? Make that jump, but it also helps that you have a coach in Arizona that understands the system in Kingsbury where he can make that connection right with Kyler Murray. How does Joe Burrow though make that jump where, you know, I think Mel had mentioned in August he was potentially a seventh rounder and maybe a fringe guy, to you saying fourth or fifth round, to now the number one pick in the draft, and he rewrote all the record books. He wins the national championship, the Heisman, and he does it in the SEC against outstanding defenses. How do you explain that type of jump in a matter of 15 games?
He needed game experience. That's it. I mean, and no one knew. Nobody knew. I mean, even talking like Urban Meyer, he always loved him, but he was, you know, fourth on the depth chart at one point. And so he just needed to go get experience. Then he needed to have Joe Brady come in and let him rip this past year. You know, give him the opportunity to open things up and go play. And I think that was the difference. When you go and study the 2018 tape, it was about running the ball. I don't want to say it was archaic, but it was old school football, and they just didn't allow him to do what he does best. And this year, when like shotgun, spread it out, even Clyde Edwards-Helaire moving him in the slot, and now you got four receivers or sometimes five receiver sets, it looks like, and just letting him make decisions and letting him go and throw the ball all around the yard. That's when he finally came into his own. But he needed game experience. Everyone does. And it took, what was it, 13 games, I think, in 2018 where he developed. And then he came back this year, and you could almost see it in the very first week of the season. He looked different. His confidence was different. He was carrying himself differently than he did the year prior. And then Brady brought out the best in him. He just allowed him to go play and be who he is. And I think, you know, if it's Cincinnati or whoever it is, that you've got to learn from that. Like you can't put him in a situation where the game slows down. He plays best when it's sped up and can just go out and throw the ball and play fast.
That's fascinating. And you mentioned, you know, when you look back at his biggest plays, it's always fast, right? It's the scramble against Georgia. It's what he's doing against Auburn. It's what he's dealing with the pass rush against Texas, and he's still finding a way to get the ball in the right windows and
getting the ball out early. That's what he, I mean, The two things that really jump out about him, well, three. One, inside the pocket, he's like Brady. He's like Aaron Rodgers. Like, he just has a feel. He's always working well inside the pocket. The second thing is he will put the ball up early and allow his receivers to go get it, and he will feed on you if the defensive back has his back to you. He knows, like, my guy's going to go get it, and so he'll take a chance, and that creates his own windows that way. And the third thing is, I've watched so much tape on Joe Burrow getting hit and knocked down by, like, you know, 310-pound dudes in the SEC and popping up and not just, like, kind of carrying himself up and working, like, popping up and ready to go. And then the next play, he'll hang in the pocket and take a hit again. And if you really study quarterbacks, after they take that big hit, usually either the coordinator is going to call a run play or they're going to get the ball out quickly because they don't want to be a part of it. He doesn't care. He doesn't flinch. He's so tough. I know, what is he, 220 pounds? But he is as tough as a quarterback that you'll ever see. And it doesn't, you know, it's not surprising that he grew up in a family of football.
Yeah, and it carries weight inside the huddle each and every time you do that. They play for you, and they want to do the extra things for you. Let's move on from the quarterbacks to the wide receivers. How would you group this set of wide receivers, especially when we could see a dozen go in the first two rounds, maybe two dozen in the first three rounds? How would you compare this class to ones we've seen in the past, including that 2004 one led by Larry Fitzgerald?
Yeah, I mean, that group was great. 2015, we had six in the first round, and that's in the last decade. It's the only time that we've had six. I think this year, I would be shocked if we got through the first night of the draft and there wasn't five. It's going to start with Jerry Jeudy from Bama. CeeDee Lamb is going to be right after him, in my opinion, coming out of Oklahoma. Then Henry Ruggs, the other Alabama wide receiver, is going to go. Brandon Ayuk is the most underrated receiver in this year's class, coming out of Arizona State. So good after the catch. Justin Jefferson is going to be, in my opinion, the fourth or fifth receiver, but will be one of the five that come off the board. So those first three, Jeudy, Lamb, and Ruggs, are going to be in somewhere in the top 15, 17. And every team in the league, if you talk to them, has those three, not necessarily in that order, but those are the top three guys, and they all have first-round grades. And then Jefferson and Ayuk will be the next two. And then it'll be interesting. T. Higgins has a chance coming out of Clemson, 6'4", 220-pound, big physical wide receiver. I don't think he's going to wind up being a first-rounder, but he would be the most likely to be that sixth guy. But if you're talking about the first three rounds, I think upwards of 18 to 20. Mm. And, you're right. You got to go back to, like, 2004 to even compare it in terms of the depth. It might not be six in the first round, but it's going to be one of the best groups we've seen in terms of the first three rounds in a couple of decades.
Yeah, you can get a steal potentially in the second round with Pittman and Chenault. It just depends on when you're picking, right? And what fits your system.
I love Michael Pittman. He's going to be a steal in the second round. You know, every year we see like three or four players in the second round that turn out to be better than, you know, most players in the first round. And I actually was on ESPN.com the other day, and they were going through every pick in the second round. And there were 17 guys that were starters or like stars, they were calling it, which is interesting. Out of 32 picks, 17 guys that were like key players, starters, and in their rookie year, you know? So Michael Pittman coming out of USC is going to be that next guy. I'm sure of it.
Could you make a case, too, that when you talk about that second round, and it's a segue here, that you're going to find also a ton of running back quality, not quantity, but a ton of quality here. And it's the Jonathan Taylors of the world who, you know, we could see DeAndre Swift. I'm not sure if you have him going in the first round, but guys like that find their way in that the late part of that first round, early part of the second round, that have a major impact?
Yeah, DeAndre Swift is the only running back coming out of Georgia in this year's class, where if you talk to everyone in the league, that's the only guy who has a true first round grade. After that, though, the depth, you're right, it's so good. Jonathan Taylor, he's the only running back in college football history to go three straight years with 1900 plus rushing yards. Now, he fumbles the ball a little bit too much. He's got to get better in pass protection, but he is instinctive a back as you'll see. And he's not like the, you know, throw out that Wisconsin thing that everyone is thinking with the running back. He has explosive speed, and he's going to be a game changer in the league, and he's going to be a starter. J.K. Dobbins out of Ohio State is the best pass protection running back in this class, and he's really instinctive and can catch the ball. He's probably going to be the second back after Swift. And then I mentioned Clyde Edwards-Helaire, who came out of, I don't want to say came out of nowhere, but he exploded onto the scene this past year. And just the way he runs, how low to the ground he is, how tough he is, and then the ability to put him in the slot and then put him out wide and know that he can actually go run a route and catch the ball. There's a lot of depth. I think all four of those guys are going to wind up going somewhere in the top 50 overall picks.
And you mentioned, the speed that Taylor has. He's a sprinter. That's like world class speed. J.K. Dobbins has the durability. If this draft was 20 years ago, you could see three of those running backs go in the top 15, right? It's just the way the game has evolved. It's just a different way. It doesn't mean that these guys aren't potential first round talents. It's just how running backs are used now. Is that the storyline here with running backs the last few years?
Yeah, it's part of it. There's going to be four or five offensive tackles that go in the first round. And then once that runs out, teams are panicked because there's not another one. Defensive linemen are going to go quickly. And then after the first round, you're really struggling. So I think teams with wide receivers and running backs are confident that we can go get one in the second or third round versus some of the other positions. So, but yeah, going back to Taylor, you just mentioned it, and the Ohio State tape was fun to watch because there's not many guys that run away from those defensive backs from Ohio State, and he did. Running away. Like that kind of speed, you can't coach it, man. You can't coach it, and he's got it.
And he's a good, smart kid. And let's go to the tackles here because the tackles are freak shows. I mean, Mekhi Becton, when you watch him at 6'7", 365, run a 5'10", 40, you're just like, your jaw just like, are you kidding me? And then to top it off, Tristan Wirfs and what he did at the combine, running a 4.85. And then the vertical, like, this is the guy.
Vertical.
Come on, that's ridiculous. Like, when he's a tackle. What are you seeing from these guys?
And Jedrick Wills is the best of all of them on tape, but he just, you know, he didn't run a 4.85. So, it's interesting to watch. But again, like, they're going to run out quickly. So that's what teams are really looking at. Like Jedrick Wills is going to go somewhere in the top 10 coming out of Bama. Tristan Wirfs, as you mentioned, with the speed and explosiveness that he has. Mekhi Becton. But then after the, I would say five offensive tackles, teams are really, really concerned about where you're going to get the next guy.
Mm. When we bring up like, you and I love those kind of numbers, a 40 time with a tackle. But how does that translate for scouts on the field when it comes to speed and the vertical? Does that just show that he's a freak of an athlete and he can handle a lot of things? How do you translate that on the field?
If you study the history of it, and it's weird, because it, like an offensive lineman's never going to run 40 yards, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the 40 yard dash correlates to NFL success more than any other workout. Like vertical jump, broad jump, all those other things, like short shuttle, all those things. Now, for interior offensive line, the short shuttle actually is the thing that correlates most. But for tackles, it's arm length and 40-yard dash that if you just look over the history, the guys who have the longest arms and run the fastest typically go on to have the best NFL careers. And it doesn't mean that you're going to have success, but it's one of those things that if you study it over a long period of time, you can see that typically those guys are going to wind up being the best players.
Now, the big storyline, of course, will be the quarterbacks and where Tua goes potentially after we see Burrow off the board against the Bengals, with the Bengals, and then Herbert and what happens with Love. And then, of course, the wide receivers will be a big storyline on day one. But when I look at the defense here, especially in the top 10, I have a feeling 5-10 years from now, we're going to talk about this defensive class in the top 10. And I'm bringing up, of course, Chase Young. You have him as the only one in your top number one tier, but behind him, his teammate Akuda, who is an outstanding cornerback. You got Isaiah Simmons. You got Derek Brown. How do you look at these guys in the top 10 and the overall defense in the first round, especially on the back end with the cornerbacks and the safeties?
Yeah. If it wasn't for quarterbacks, that's all we would be talking about. Cause Chase Young, he's not the Boses. And I've talked about it a bunch before. And I love both of the Boses coming out of school, and I didn't care what they ran. You know, Joey ran a 4.8 something. Nick ran a 4.78, I think it was. But the leverage and the hand usage and all of that, they were NFL ready. Chase Young is NFL ready. He's not as technically sound as the Boses, but he's more athletic. He's more explosive. Like if you just watch, like the speed that he has, the bend, the athleticism, and then the 16 and a half sacks he had, six of them were strip sacks. He knows how to get that ball loose. And you think about how important that is. That the strip sack is huge, and that's what he excels at. So, yeah, Chase Young is, to me, the number one overall player in this class. Okuda, Jeff Okuda, the cornerback from Ohio State, is one of the best corners we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years coming out. Like, he's that good. Derek Brown is so overlooked, the Auburn defensive tackle. You put him at nose tackle, and he will work your center. I mean, he will bull rush that center and drive him right back in your quarterback's face, and he does it over and over again. I think a team's going to wind up probably like 7 or 8 wind up getting Derek Brown, and we'll look back and say, how did he last that long? And then Isaiah Simmons is not as polished in terms of taking on blocks and instincts with the run game, but find me another 6'3", 240-pound guy that can play in the box, play in the slot, cover your tight end, cover some wide receivers, and then go play free safety. That play against Ohio State will be ingrained in my mind forever. When he was playing single high safety, read the quarterback's eyes, and went about 30, 35 yards and went up and took the ball away like he was the wide receiver. There are not many dudes that can go do that. So when you're talking about Chase Young, Okuda, Derek Brown, and Simmons, all, I think, arguably 5 of the 6 or 7 best players in this entire draft, but someone's going to get a steal because we know that Burrow's going to go. We know that Tua Tagovailoa is going to go. Jerry Jeudy will probably sneak in there because the team's looking for him. So someone's going to get a real steal with one of these defensive players.
You know, my favorite line from Isaiah Simmons is they asked him what position he plays, and he said defense, because he's the evolution. You know, this is where we go now when we're looking for that hybrid linebacker that can literally do anything and everything. And Venables did a great job with him at Clemson and finding a way to make sure he was playing a huge role while they lost a lot of that Sunday talent from a year ago to now replace it in last year and what they did. And Simmons is a fantastic kid, and I love the talent on the defensive side. Is there one guy or multiple guys that we're not talking about that, you know, you think day two, day three, that would stand out?
Ross Blacklock from TCU, defensive tackle, I think is one of the more underrated players in this entire draft. He's just an up the field, frustrating type of defensive tackle. It's just always kind of in your backyard. He's just always frustrating. I think he's I mean, no one really knows that name, right?
Nope.
Yeah, I think that he, and maybe he could go late first, maybe early second, but I think Blacklock's he's got a chance to be one of the better players in this class. I mean, Antoine Winfield Jr. is so good.
I'm so glad you brought him up, and I know you love him. That Penn State game, he was incredible. So I'm glad you brought him up. Go ahead.
He was incredible. So Kuiper, once a year he gets me. Once a year, and he kept on mentioning Antoine Winfield Jr. And I hadn't done his tape from the preseason. I didn't have any Minnesota games. I was trying to catch up on him, and so I put on that Penn State tape. The first play, I have no idea what happened. The second play, he goes and takes, I think it was a wide receiver or a tight end, like 10 yards down the field, was trying to block him, and he just, get out of the way, and makes a tackle in the open field. And then the third play, he opens his hips, turns and runs and goes and high points the ball and takes, you know, gets the interception, takes the ball away. And after those three plays, I was like, oh, Kuiper was right.
Yeah, and for our audience, listen, when you guys were first introduced, I think people were like, oh, who's this young kid with Todd McShay trying to, you know, ruffle the feathers with Mel Kuiper? You guys have developed such a great relationship and respect for each other. How would you describe, you know, you and Kuiper going back and forth, starting in like, you know, late January leading up to the draft? What's it like for you guys?
It's interesting. We're like 6 months a year, really good friends. But we're also like, it's like any friend that you have, just passionate about something. You can get in an argument, and I legitimately sometimes get upset with him, and he legitimately will get upset with me. But the second we're done, everything's fine. I'll never forget. I think the first time we ever got in an argument on air, I was, so Gary Horton started me in this business. He worked for Bill Belichick, as a scout. He was in Tampa Bay. He was, he worked for Arizona State. He started me in this business and got me into it. And the first year that I was doing it, I was down in Charlotte, and it was for ESPNU. We were doing the draft. And I got in, we had a, you know, back and forth, and Mel was in New York for the draft. And Gary called me right after and was like, hey, Todd, Mel's really upset. And I was like, oh no. Like, no, he's pissed. Like, you can't go back and forth with him like that. You cannot have an argument like that. You embarrassed him. He went through this whole thing, and I was I felt horrible. I was like 27 years old. You know, I was trying to like go back and forth and thought we were doing the right thing. And then I hear Kuiper in the background giggling. He grabbed Gary's phone and is like, McShay, I don't ever care. I don't ever care. I love it.
That is an awesome story. And then that perfectly describes Mel. Mel is so cool about everything, and he's passionate about what he does. But at the same time, like, you know, once you're done talking about it, he moves on, and
he's good.
He's as good as anybody you could ever see and talk to, you know, and that's what I love about.
I was sick last week, and he called and checked in on me, you know, and then I talked to him 2 days ago, checking in on his family and making sure everything was okay. Like that, we definitely go back and forth at each other, and we're competitive. But I love that guy, and no one's been more supportive of me and my career than Mel Kuiper. And I'll always be appreciative of what he's done.
That's amazing. And one of the reasons why you guys have hit the mainstream, we all know what you guys do. It's just the skit with, Caliendo. When you first saw that skit and then you saw it being played nonstop, what was it like for you, especially the ta, 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 ta? Like, what was your reaction to it all?
So First of all, he was in makeup for 8 hours, I think. Seth Markman, I'll never forget. I was trying to go back to Boston that day. And Seth's like, you can't. We have to tape this thing. Caliendo's been in makeup for 8 hours already. I was like, all right, gotcha. And so we wound up taping it. I think it was like 8 or 9 o'clock at night, whatever it was. And I think we were on for like, I don't know, 45, 50 minutes of going back and forth. And then we were done. We were finishing up and Frank came over and was like, all right, is there anything you can tell me about Mel that, that I maybe didn't see? And he said he had watched, he said like 40 hours of tape on Mel just to get the voice down. Something crazy. But so at the end, I was like, let me think. I was like, you know, Mel says my first name and I don't like my first name. I still to this day yell at my mom about Todd. I think it's an 80s
yuppie. You don't like Todd?
Yeah, I don't like it. But Mel says my first name more than any human being has ever said it. and he's like, so we did all these takes and all these different things. And he's like, all right, let's just do one take and we'll be done. And he went back to wherever he was sitting and he did that whole, and I was sitting there. He's like, Todd, 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 Todd. And that's it.
That's incredible. That is, and here's the thing. No one at home knows that you don't like your name, and that's Caliendo's little dig at you.
You got the exclusive on that.
That's great. Before we let you go, we do want to ask this, and I'm curious about it too. How are you handling things? Like, what's it been like for you? Has anything changed? You know, you're obviously not making trips to Bristol, but you're still working. What's it like for you to, during this worldwide crisis and this pandemic where we're all at home and we have kids, and you're balancing your work at home? What's it been like for you?
Well, I've moved studios twice. And now it's in my kids' playroom. My wife and kids left to go to get away simply because I'm doing TV and working all the time. So they had to kind of go and get away and I'm not going to see them for a month and I miss them like crazy. That's been the hardest thing. Like I'm sitting here and I've got papers and notes and stuff everywhere. And I've got my tape over there and the studio and in the kids' playroom. But the hardest part is FaceTiming with them every day and just, you know, I'm missing them. I miss them a lot. It's tough.
Yeah. I can only imagine.
I always was crazy and I was always working a ton, but I would come home from Bristol after 4 days of TV.
Yep.
I would at least be around at night. And now I don't get to see him at all. It sucks. It's tough.
Yeah. Cause it's a good distraction. You know, you also for like 1 or 2 hours, you're not thinking about mock drafts, right?
And right.
You're helping your wife, because, you know, let's be honest, when we're in this business, you know, our spouses are doing a lot of the stuff that we would like to share with, but we can't. And now it's taken on the task of all by herself. And, that's a credit to you guys in understanding, like you're locked in your work and your job. But at the same time, our kids are the one thing I've noticed, Todd, about this whole thing. Our kids are more adjustable than we give them credit.
I know they're dealing with it way better than I am.
Yes. It's incredible. Like at one point I told my wife yesterday, I said, do we need to like take them for a car ride? And she's like, you're thinking way too much. She's like, they are so happy that they can run around and they could be outside and they can come back in the house. Why would you just keep them locked up in a car and just drive around? I'm like, I don't know. I'm just thinking that maybe I'd see something. And she's like, stop it. They're good. And she's like, you're thinking for them, but you're thinking like a 45-year-old when they're 7, 6, and 3 and they're just happy you're home and we're playing around. I'm like, that's a good point. So
yeah. I've also learned I'm terrible at keeping like the kitchen together. I'm decent at dishes, but I procrastinate.
Yeah.
I'm terrible at laundry. I can't fold anything.
All right, so we'll make you
in the last couple of weeks.
When it comes to being a spouse, you're like a sixth or seventh round pick right now. If the laundry's an issue and all that, right? Hey, Todd, we do appreciate you joining us here in the College Football Podcast, and we know the next 2 weeks are a grind. So thanks for carving out the time, and of course, stay safe to you and your family.
You got it, Kev. Same to you. Take care, bud.